I was talking to Carla the other day and mentioned that I often feel kind of like a stand-up comic in this role, except for the fact that I don't get to stand up because we don't have the wireless microphones and so forth that would allow me to do that. And I've thought about the fact that in public meetings like this, there's very little ground that we can cover, actually. I see, even in a small gathering like this, one or two people who I have not seen before, and who, therefore, I would assume don't know what it is that I have to say, and probably don't even think they know what it is I have to say. So that public meetings like this are different than other venues that are more long-lasting, like weekly meetings or retreats or intensives and things like that, when we can go deeper, go farther anyway. Pretty much I have the same thing to say all the time in public meetings, which means that I have the same shtick, really. And I was thinking when I was talking to Carla that those guys really kind of have it made because they have the same routine. They tour and travel around and they do the same routine every night. And they may change it and enhance it and, you know, develop it and become better at it and so forth. But they always, when they go out on that stage, they always know what it is that they're going to say, basically. And I never do, even though I always say the same thing. I never do. And I have thought sometimes that it might be of some benefit or some value to actually have a pre-formulated talk that I would present in a public meeting like this that might change from time to time or enhance itself, or I might get better at delivering it and so forth. But that doesn't seem to happen, and I always, as we gather together and I sit down up here, I sit down without the slightest idea of what it is that I am going to say to you. So, one thing that's possible is that if anybody here has anything that they'd like to talk about, we could talk about that. And I'd be happy to do so. The other alternative is to do what I usually do, which is just to start talking about the first thing that comes to mind, which tonight, and feel free to interrupt me and tell me that this is not what we want to talk about, but which tonight is the business of lineage. It's something I don't think I've ever said that word in satsang before. But we're in the process of refreshing, redoing, reimagining our website. And in the process of considering that and considering what we want to have on the website and how we want it to be of service, of course, we have a page that is about the lineage, this lineage, whatever that is. And we have always, in the past, we have traced a kind of, you know, and this is kind of ordinary in spiritual circles, this business of lineage and lineage holders and that whole array of things. And the basic reason for it, it seems to me, is to bestow on the one who claims the lineage some vestige of authority for speaking as they do, you know, that at least somebody somewhere said, yeah, that guy ought to be talking to people. Somebody of some stature. So since it was Gangaji that had got me into this mess in the first place, it is Gangaji that I speak about first on the lineage page. And since Gangaji's teacher was Papaji, there's something about Papaji on the lineage page. And since Papaji's teacher was Ramana, and since Ramana is at the heart of everything I speak about, there is stuff about Ramana on the lineage page. So that it, you know, it presents some kind of a linear, development of Ramana to Papaji to Gangaji to me, to you. But I really don't like that very much. When we first started in this role, we, you know, it just kind of fell on us, and we didn't know what we were doing, and we just did what everybody else did. That's what we do. That's what we as human beings do. Faced with some new circumstance, we try to figure out what everybody else does and then do that, only better or different or something. So we just did what everybody else seemed to be doing, and I was uncomfortable with it in the beginning, and I remained so. But to present this idea that there is this linear chain of some teaching that runs from Ramana to Papaji to Gangaji to me, to you. But that really isn't my experience. It's really not my experience in this role, in this life. If I am in a lineage, I would have to say that I am in the lineage of human beings. What I mean by that is this. It seems to me that if you look back over human history, and God knows it's a horror story, but if you look at that aspect of it that has to do with human aspirations, spiritual aspirations, you'll see that from the very beginning, really, from the very beginning, from the very inception of this sense of individual consciousness, of a sense of self, a sense of a me, the really bizarre sense that I am something, that we have from the very beginning, from the inception of that, we have been trying this way and that way, some other way, some new way, some old way, to solve the problem of human existence. The problem of human existence being that, well, it kind of sucks. We're given this enormous gift of consciousness and the consciousness of consciousness, the awareness that I am conscious and I don't know what that is, but there's this sense of promise in the experience of being human. And what I see is that from the very beginning, the aspiration, the spiritual aspiration, has been us trying without a guidebook, without any idea whatsoever of what we're doing, to fulfill that promise. And the promise is so huge, it is so vast, it has no boundaries to it. It's just this feeling that things ought to be real, true, seen. So we've been trying to fulfill this promise from the beginning, really. And, of course, our time and our attention there's competition for our time and attention, so that there's not that much time and attention and intelligence that we have to bring to bear to this underlying existential problem of human existence, because we also have to feed ourselves and take care of ourselves and make sure we survive and don't get killed off, and so that the the really important business of being human is put aside because we don't have time for it. And we hear about the attainments of others. From the very beginning, we have been hearing about the attainments of others. And we hear from the disciples of these others that things are not as they seem, that really, really, it's true, the promise is true, and it is ours to realize, to fulfill, to receive. And as proof of that, we hold up the examples of, you know, like the ancient ones, the ancient beings who have, we are told, seen the promise fulfilled. Shankara and the Buddha and many of them. God knows. You know, those we have never heard of in traditions that we know nothing of. But one thing we can be certain of is that in every place where there have been human beings who have gathered together, there has been this sense of thirst and the sense of a promise that wants to be fulfilled and that I don't know what to do about and that I am bereft as a result of this. And everywhere that humans have gathered, there have been those who have come to us and said, look, look, it's true, it's all true. Oh, look, just stop for a second and look and you'll see. It's all true. And stories have been told about them and lineages have developed out of them, out of their experience in the Aboriginal peoples in this country, in China, in all over the world, in all kinds of traditions that are recognizably and not so recognizably spiritual in nature. There has been this underlying thirst, this underlying desire to have the promise of life fulfilled. And since we don't have so much time to devote to that, we are left with the reports of others heard from distance, from a distance, as recounted by their disciples or the disciples of their disciples or some other lineage holders further down the line. For most of us, maybe the spiritual aspiration never becomes paramount in the life. Never, the opportunity never arises for it to become central and paramount. But for all, this thirst is here. For all, this sense of a promise yet to be fulfilled is here. Because we're human, and I know it. No different than me. None of them. Now, the thing about this business of lineage and about this business of the reports of the success of others in attaining the promise of human existence, the thing about it is that it always comes also with a set of instructions as to how we should, what we should do in order to attain what this one or that one or the other one attained, what drugs we should take, what practices we should undertake, what what we should do. And we gladly, if we can, if we have within the circumscribed nature of our own life and our own circumstances, if we can, we gladly take on these practices. And we read the poetry and the songs and the sutras and the Upanishads and then the Gitas, and we are filled with hope and joy because these things seem to speak directly to us, to our own heart. They resonate with us in our own heart. And we are told that if we will do this and this and this, that we too will transcend this ordinary consciousness, that we too will see the fulfillment of the promise. If only we will follow this road or this path or some other path. And that's what's to be expected, right? I mean, somebody discovers something enormously important to all of humanity, past and present and future. It is to be expected that we will, it's our nature to try to figure out, what can we do to get that? What can I do so that I can get to what he is at? That's our nature. It's what's to be expected. And that's what we do. And we write stories and we write sutras and we write these things and we create these precepts and these instructions as to what should be done, how we should live our life, or how we should meditate, or how we should receive the transmission of some guru, or all the different ways, all of the different ways in which we have figured out some method whereby we can get what they have. And we're happy to do that. I mean, really, if somebody tells me you will fulfill the promise of your life if you will join this club and do these practices and religiously do what I tell you to do, well, I'm happy to do that. I really, you know, tell me what to do and I'll do it. Of course, in our individual lives, it seems like it never works. Not as I expected it to, anyway. It never works. I must have stumbled into the wrong teaching, or it's not suitable for me. Because I know that all those other people who have been doing this practice for the thousands of years that this lineage has been passed down from one generation to the next, I know that they have gotten what they wanted. Otherwise, they wouldn't continue the lineage, right? But it doesn't work for me. Well, my idea is this. If we look at it really closely, we can see, you know, like this is America, right? This is the new world. This is a whole different ball game than has been the case in ancient times and in other places. We don't have this lengthy lineage backward, so that our main defining characteristic, those of us who have been born and raised in the new world, our main defining quality, useful quality, is pragmatism. That's what we do. That's how come we have all these freeways and all this global warming and all these wars and all this, all these things, televisions and internet and so forth, because we're pragmatic. We try to find what works and doesn't work and do what works. But the truth is that none of these, none of them, not the Vedas, not the shamans, not the Shankara, not Advaita, not the Upanishads, not the Buddha, not the all of the infinite number of lineages that have sprouted from the brow of the Buddha, not Christ, not Islam, not the churches, not practice, not meditation, not anything has ever worked. None of it. Because if it worked, if it had worked, we would not be seeking what we do not have. How long does it take, for God's sake? There is but one mind. How long does it take if what we have been told to do works, how long would it take for this stupidity of human behavior to disappear? Certainly not. What, 5,000 years? 10,000 years? Certainly not that long. In fact, not only doesn't it work, it keeps getting worse. I mean, we're worse now than we were 100 years ago, right? That's my understanding of it. It seems like we're worse now than we were 60 years ago, and I can speak to that. So none of it works. I mean, it's all really beautiful, really beautiful. I read the sutras and the Upanishads. I read the all of that beautiful Rumi, all of it. So gorgeous. It just makes my heart swell and sing and well, want what he has. But here we are, still grubbing about, still going from one teacher to the next, from one teaching to the next, from one way of living our life to the next, still keeping time, pacing our way to the grave, wishing things were different. So, to me, the lineage is the lineage of humanity. We have been trying together for all of these thousands of years to figure out what to do about ourselves. And so far, we have failed. We have had really wondrous events that have occurred in this effort to figure ourselves out, like the advent of the Buddha, like the advent of Shankara, you know, the shamans, we've had wonderful, I don't know all of them, but we have wonderful instances of the breaking open of reality so that it shines on us. And still, we seek some practice, some answer, some understanding that will put an end to this sense that the promise isn't fulfilled, that life is, in fact, a false promise. But we're all in it together. From the beginning, we're in it together. So that all of those efforts and all of those attempts and all of those partial successes that have happened throughout the entirety of human history, we stand on that, and we drink from that, and we should learn from that. We can see if we look at all of them. And I really think, you know, and I sometimes I think these days that maybe I should just devote my time to finding the ways in which this has been said in all of the spiritual aspirations, and because it has been, I am certain of that. All of them tell us the same thing, and that's the thing to look for, right? Not what has grown out of these openings that have occurred, but what is the immediate report. Not what comes later, not when time has passed enough for people to figure out how can I say this better and How can I offer this to people in a way that they will get what I'm offering and so forth. But the immediate reports from those who have seen reality, they all have things in common about them. Chief among them is the intuition, the insight, that our problem is that we are not what we think we are. And that's said in a lot of different ways, and it can be misinterpreted and misunderstood. But if you look for yourself and see, you will see that what I say is true. They all have said that. Doesn't matter in what religious tradition or what spiritual tradition or what magical tradition or anything. The claim is consistent and runs through it all that our problem is that we are not what we think we are. That's the problem. Our problem isn't that we need these experiences of bliss and the transcendence of ordinary consciousness and oceanic consciousness and so forth. That's never the claim. Never. Never. Our problem isn't the lack of experience. Our problem is that we are not what we think we are. And since we believe ourselves to be what we are not, we suffer. I believe myself to be this John Sherman character. It's not true, but for a long time it was true. I believe myself to be this body and mind that was born in 1942 and that has a checkered history that I can recount, and that I believe myself to be this guy who needs this and doesn't need that, wants this and doesn't want that, and so forth. But it's not true. If it were true, then all of my suffering and misery and unhappiness and aggression and hatred and self-betrayal would be justifiable and make sense, really. If I were what I believe myself to be, then it would be entirely reasonable for me to take from you so that I can have what you have. It would be entirely reasonable for me to lie to you, to trick you, to make you think something else than is true in order that I can get something from you or protect myself from your aggression. If I am what I believe myself to be, then it's entirely reasonable for me to seek power and pleasure and sex and money and fame and immortality. Entirely reasonable for me to fear death. Entirely reasonable for me to put me above all else. Above you, for sure. If I am what I believe myself to be, then it's entirely reasonable for me to say that life sucks. I mean, really. You know, I mean, consider this, right? Here I am. I'm a guy who I am approaching 64 years old. I spent, all told, probably 20, 25 years in prisons. Once I was in for 18 and a half years at one time. I have never succeeded at anything I've ever tried to do. I am a failed student. I am a failed machinist. I am a failed soldier. I'm a failed husband. I'm a failed revolutionary. I'm a failed bank robber. I am a failed convict. It was only 9 years ago. Is that right? 9 years, 10 years, 12 years ago. It was only 12 years ago that for the first time in this life, it occurred to me that maybe, just maybe, I am not what I think I am, and that just maybe life is sweet. So what that means is that other 52 years were just wasted. You know, I mean, I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody. I could have. I mean, I'm smart and I'm well spoken and I'm, you know, I carry myself pretty well. I could have been somebody. I could have been a politician. I could have been rich. I could have been, and damn, I don't know what it is. What is it that stopped me from doing that? But it hurts me to my heart that I've wasted my life. I mean, if I am who I have believed myself to be, then that would be an entirely reasonable outlook, would it not? Wasted life. Wasted. Angry, bitter, resentful. And they have all of them told us that the heart of the problem is just this, that I am not what I believe myself to be. The heart of the problem is just this, that there operates within me an unexamined, profoundly deep-seated belief that I am the story. And we've heard that. And out of the hearing of that have come all kinds of spiritual theories and practices and desires. The ego is the problem. I mean, that's what I am falsely identified with, is ego. And therefore, ego is the problem. It's my understanding, it's my experience in these matters that to the extent that the problem of misidentification is overtly held to be, explicitly held to be, the problem that needs to be dealt with, to the extent that it is, to that extent, what mostly is seen is that what has to be done about it is to eliminate the object of misidentification, to kill off the ego, and then we get into all these real sexy ego death and, you know, all these 18th century romantic notions of death and reformation, death and transcendence. But that doesn't work either. I mean, it seems like the idea that the only problem is the fact that I falsely believe myself to be this ego, and I'm using ego in the normal sense now of this whole complex that I believe myself to be, which isn't really what it is, but it's what passes for ego in most of the spiritual community. So if the problem is that I am wrongly identified, that I wrongly believe myself to be ego, then obviously what has to happen is that ego must die. And that doesn't work either. You know, really, obviously. I mean, look at us. Look around. There have been many, many, many hundreds of years, thousands of years, seeking the eradication of ego. Many beautiful theoretical ideas about no mind and being finished with thought and emptiness and so forth, all to no avail. We are still, all of us, human beings, subject to the same misery and false promise that we have always been. And you see, it's not enough that someone claims that they have broken free. That doesn't mean that it works. We are truly in this together, all of us. There are not two humans. Now, the amazing thing about this, and here we come to I don't know how to refer to him. He's not a saint. He's not a god. He's not a, I don't know what he is. He's you. This guy, Ramana Maharshi, this guy stumbled upon reality before he had been weighted down with the enormous spiritual and religious tradition that is endemic in India. He was only 17 years old. So he had not had the chance to get this burden of spiritual understanding. Ground into him. And he saw very clearly what all of them have seen, and that is that the only problem is a false belief about what I am. That's what he saw. That's what he told us all. The only problem is a false belief about what I am. And to Ramana, it was really obvious that the solution to that was not to destroy something that I believe myself to be, or not to come up with some brand new, fresh, and shiny belief about what I am, like I am Buddha mind or infinite consciousness or whatever. The solution to the problem of a false belief about what I am is really simple. It's to find out the truth of what I am. And not only is it really simple and the obvious solution, duh, it's the only solution. Nothing else works. Nothing else works. So the wondrous thing about the offering of Ramana Maharshi is this. He brings us what we already know, which is that I am not what I think I am. We know that. We fight against it. We work with it really hard because, I mean, after all, it's all we got, right? I mean, these bodies, these minds, these histories, and so forth. But we know that that's not what I am. And we know by our natural intelligence that if I am afflicted with a false belief, the only solution to that is the truth. So he brings that to us and he says, look, here's the deal. You are not what you believe yourself to be. Therefore, find out what you are. And what you are is here. Always. Always. Never changing. Never moving, unaffected, absolutely still, unchanged, here. Never absent, here. So how hard can it be to find out what you are? You are here. You are always here. It may not be possible for you, in fact, it almost certainly is not possible for anyone, to bring into their consciousness of the story, a complete developed understanding of what I am, because, I mean, well, that's a story. But I know what I am. I know it just as sure as I see you sitting there. I know it, and you know it too. You know it. I am here. I've never changed. I am here. I am untouched, unmoved by pleasure, by pain, by bliss, by suffering. And when the false belief about what I am dies, as it does, when that false belief dies, this life is revealed to be the fulfillment of the promise itself. This life is revealed to be sweet and easy, open-hearted and generous, uncomplicated. Really. So, And it is that, even if it consists in efforts to attain spiritual experience, or efforts to get rich, or efforts to feel better, or efforts to find pleasure. None of those things, none of that, none of those practices touch you at all. None of them. When I am free of this false belief, life itself reveals itself to be what it has always been, which is this sweetness, this meeting, the appearance of the idea of separate existence within a field of one consciousness, not two. The appearance of this sensation and experience of separate existence is revealed to be such a gift, so gorgeous, so beautiful, not to be done away with, not to be destroyed. Ramana tells us that all we have to do, we don't have to stop anything we're doing, we don't have to change anything we're doing, we don't have to become saints, we don't have to become sinners, we don't have to become enlightened, we don't have to become ignorant. All we have to do is look in this moment and see what it is I am, directly, without a thought. Unmediated, direct. What am I? Ramana tells us that if we will do that, all else will be taken care of. All the but whatabouts will be taken care of. Because Ramana tells us, as they all have, that the only problem in being human is a false belief about what we are. And the only solution is to know the truth. And we already know the truth. And then what we discover is that in all of our spiritual efforts to transcend ordinary consciousness, we have been fooling ourselves that realization, the deepest, the most powerful realization, is ordinary consciousness, which is you, just as you are. Nothing changed, nothing kept from changing, just you. So what I offer in these meetings is this opportunity to try for yourself over however long a period you do, to try for yourself this gift of Ramana Maharshi, which is the power that we have to move our attention away from the objects that have so enthralled us. It's a good word, enthralled. We are enthralled to these things. To move our attention away from the objects that have so enthralled us, and just for a second, move it back to this reality of here that I am. Just to taste that. Just for a second. And to do it again. And to do it again, whenever it occurs to you, over the next time, to do it again. And do it again. And let the story be as it will. Let all the carping go on that will go on. All the, oh yeah, but what about, all that stuff, it's okay. Can't hurt you, can't do anything for you, can't do anything against you. Just do this. This is what I offer, is this possibility just to do this over the next period, whenever you can, stop for 1 second and look to see what you are. Taste it. What is it that makes you certain that you're here? How can you say that you are here? What is the present sensational experience that you rely upon to know you are? Because that's what you are. That's the truth. And nobody can give that to you, and nobody can take that away from you, and nobody can explain that to you, and nobody can tell you you're wrong about what you think about it. You are here. There is no transmission that can occur that can give you this sense of here-ness. There's no Shakti pot behind it. You are here, always, always here. I also might be briefer if I had a prepared talk. I might not take quite so long. But I'm done. Anybody want to talk about it? Argue about it? Anything about it? Yes, yes. Come. Forgive me if I don't quite have your name down yet.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
You've suggested to us, or to me, since I've heard you, to ask the question, who am I? And this is the third time I'm coming here, and in doing that, I don't know who I am. Like, I don't know if I'm one person or if I'm many. In asking that question, I suspect that there is no such thing as Kasti per se. Kasti is comprised of hundreds of different cells on the surface of my life. I'm a Turk. I was born and raised in Turkey. I speak Russian, so my first language was Russian. Am I a Russian? Am I a Turk? Am I an American? I've been in this country since 63. I'm a father, pot smoker. All these eyes, and there's hundreds of these selves that operate on the surface of my life. And so it feels kind of claustrophobic. I tend to feel claustrophobic, but when I come here, it's different. It's different. It's like those eyes are not operating here. And there seems to be a gap. Like, I feel a certain way when I'm here, and then a few hours after I leave here, then the world of the eyes and the world of the lies, as I call it, comes back into operation, little by little. What's the obstacle in my way that prevents me from holding on to this feeling of spaciousness, this feeling that, even if I have questions in my mind, 10, 20 questions, the compulsion to ask those questions goes away when I come here. It's not that important. I'm just content to be being here and now. It's very peaceful. I like the way I feel. But it's not going to be that way 3-4 hours from now. That's what's been coming up. The selves take over, you know, Kasti the worker, Kasti the father, Kasti that's struggling.
So here my question is, and I'm a little reluctant to get into talking about states that are not here, you know, because we're really just talking about memory and a storyline, but my question nevertheless is this. You have feelings here that when you leave here, other feelings come and displace the feeling that you have here.
I become more fragmented.
Right.
Well, I feel fragmented.
And what's the problem with that? Why is that a problem?
Because I seem to lose my connection with being here and I'm not conscious.
And
that is the biggest problem. I don't.
Well, if you're really not conscious, then you wouldn't even notice this fragmentation. I mean, what I hear you saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that in the midst of this fragmentation, you have the certain sense that there's a problem, that you wish it were different than it is.
It's maybe one half of 1% out of 99.9%. Maybe 1% of the time I feel like, okay, I'm here and now. And all the other times it's like I'm...
Right, I understand that, but... What is the problem with all those other times, with the feeling that is associated with all those other times? Why is that a problem? I mean, what if you are fragmented? And you see, you must see, right, that these feelings, they cycle. Like here with me in this meeting, there's a feeling of spaciousness and quiet and so forth. And then leaving here, there's other feelings that come and go and these feelings cycle. They come and go and reassert themselves. And it wouldn't be true, I don't think, for you to say that there are no times except when you were here in satsang, that you don't have a feeling of peace.
True.
Right, you do. And true. So these feelings, all of them, good feelings and bad feelings, they come to you and then they leave you.
True.
Right? And it is natural for you, it really is, absolutely natural for you to see that you prefer the feeling of spaciousness to the feeling of claustrophobia and fragmentation.
I don't want to feel negative.
Right, and that's absolutely natural, you know. I mean, I would much rather feel, happy and not in pain and so forth than feel fragmented and kind of confused and didn't know what I was doing. And that's natural. There's nothing wrong with that. So, and yet, it must also be your experience that that's always the case. I mean, even before you ever heard of satsang, your life consisted of a kind of endless story of ups and downs, of feeling good, feeling bad. You know, I get high, don't get high, all kinds of things. But the natural story of your life is a story of ups and downs.
Yes. Right?
Okay. Now, so what? What does that have to do with this issue of what you are?
That's what I don't know. Right. What am I? I know what I am not.
I tell you that you are no more the feeling of spaciousness and open-hearted than you are the feeling of fragmentation and claustrophobia. That both those feelings, since they are impermanent, since they are not here and then they are here, and the feeling of spaciousness is here and then it's not here, that none of those things are real, and none of those things will give you what you're looking for. Like, it's natural to feel that what I'm looking for is the permanent presence of this feeling of spaciousness that excludes the feelings of fragmentation and claustrophobia. That's natural for you to think that to be the case. But I suggest to you that that's the source of the whole dog and pony show from the very beginning, is identifying what feels good and trying to make what feels good permanent and what feels bad inexistent. And the reason that that's the whole dog and pony show is because of a deep-seated belief that you are this story of alternating feelings of good and bad. And I say you're not that. And I say that these alternating feelings of good and bad may be entertaining and they may even be interesting and they may even make life worth living. But they cannot hurt you. So that all of your efforts to make permanent what's good and eliminate what's bad is just putting your efforts in the wrong spot. You are here, right? Right now, you're here. Can't deny it. That undeniable reality of being here is you. And that undeniable reality of being here is the ground in which all this other plays. There will come to you as we sit here, you know, feelings of spaciousness and open-heartedness and peace. But that's not you. That's a feeling that's passing through. And in the presence of the most beautiful, soft, sweet feelings of spaciousness and peace, it's possible for you to stop right there in that moment and say, okay, what am I? Not, am I this, but what am I? I am here. I'm always here. There's never been a time when I'm absent. There has never been a time when I have been spacious, and then another time when I have been fragmented. I am always the same. Now, the point of this exercise, this practice, and is what I urge upon you, is just that. Without looking to the story for confirmation of what you are. And that's what we do, right? We hear this and it makes great sense to us. And when I speak with you and call your attention to this reality that's here, that you are, you see it very clearly and you say, yes, yes, I see that. But because we have such a long history of this deep belief that I am this story of feeling good and then feeling bad and so forth, feeling complete and feeling empty and all of that, it's natural for me to see the appearance of the feeling of spaciousness and peace as a confirmation of having attained something. And seeing the feeling of fragmentation and claustrophobia as confirmation of having lost something.
It's more like the promise of hope that you talked about is what I feel here. The promise of something.
Yes, yes, but
finer.
But really, really, in that, right? That's a story about what's here. It's not bad. It's not. You know, it's really possible for to hear when I say it's a story to hear that as a bad. It's no good. It's a story, but it is. It's just a story about what's here. What you are is what's here. You can see that in this moment. Just, you can't tell me anything about it. Although the life will try to and create a story of feeling of spaciousness and the possibility of the fulfillment of the promise and so forth. But you really can't tell me anything about it. I can see in your eyes, I can see in your countenance when your attention has touched this eternal reality that's here. But you can't tell me anything about it. I can't tell you anything about it. But I can tell you this, and this is from my heart, that if you will pay no mind to the endlessly fluctuating experiences of good and bad that make up this story, this character. I mean, there would be no character for us to admire and like and be friends with were it not for these fluctuating stories of good and bad and all of that. It's absolutely possible for you to pay no mind to it, not even to want that to go away. Because that's what we mostly do when we get all spiritual, right? We want all that stuff to go away. And we want it to be, well, we want to transcend that ordinary consciousness. But if you can pay no mind to that at all, and just in the midst of it, and especially in the midst of when the feelings of open-heartedness and spaciousness are present, just don't worry about that and move your attention to see this permanent here-ness. Just for a second. Then your addiction to the story and to how it turns out will be cured over time. I promise. But you have to take the medicine over time.
What's the medicine?
The medicine is turning your attention to this unchanging reality of here-ness that we've spoken of every time we've spoken. Not so that you are forever sunk in some samadhi, but just for one second, just turn your attention fully, directly, and without compromise to this feeling of being, of existence, the certainty that you are here. If you'll do that, whenever you can, without looking to the story to see whether it's working, I promise you that the addiction to this story will be cured.
I hope the story has an end.
And you know, the story, it's not to say the story won't continue to go on just as it has. It won't exactly as it has, because it never does exactly as it has. But we're not in here to fix the story, really. That's what hasn't worked. That's what we've been trying to do for 10,000 years, is fix the story, and it hasn't worked. What we can do is eradicate this false belief.
Is it not necessary to see the story, to see the story that I'm generating in my own head?
There's nothing in the story, right, that is of any use to you. That's what I'm telling you. There's nothing in the story that's of any use to you. There's nothing in the story that can harm you. You don't need to concern yourself about the story. You can continue it just as you're doing. When you are unmindful of what's real, it's quite all right. No problem with that. You can be all caught up in trying to fix things and make things right. I guarantee you that the moment will come when you, it will occur to you and say, wait a minute. Okay, let me try this just for a second. What am I? What am I? What was it that he said? He said, look and see if I am not here. Am I here? How do I know that? That's all. Story can't help you with that. The story can't hinder you from that. That's all that's required. That's the great, radical, incomprehensible gift of Ramana, is to see that. That's all that's required. You don't have to be a saint. You don't have to fix the story. You don't have to stop fixing the story. You just have to see what you are as often as you can manage. Okay?
Thank you.
You're very welcome. I'm very happy to speak with you.
I'd like to do that some more.
Okay. Okay. Anything else? I think I've managed to bogart most of the time tonight. But does anybody else have anything they'd like to say or speak with me about? Because I'll stay all night if we have to. Okay. I am forever grateful for your attention. Thank you so much for this satsang. Om Shanti. May all being know itself. That's just that. That's the only prayer. May all being know itself directly here. Om Shanti.